Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Oh, it's not that funny. Welcome back, everybody. 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Steve now in Roseville, California. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Patrick. I wanted some guidance around dealing with proper distribution of an estate. And so from a Catholic perspective, a Catholic wisdom perspective, you know, let's pretend, you know, generic example of, you know, 10 children that are to be beneficiaries. And then when it comes to A, the type of life they're living, is it honoring their parents or honoring Christ? B, mm-hmm. how much involvement do they have in the care and welfare of the parents? You know, obviously there could be a whole spectrum of those who are willing to help and jump in, and those who are just going to be opportunistic and sit on the sidelines, or just simply living a life that probably wouldn't warrant the gift, right? If the estate was a gift from God to the parents, should the parents take a little more care and attention as to how they distribute that gift to their beneficiaries? So that's the question.
Yeah, I could see why that would be of concern. Now, when you're describing this, the first thing that came to my mind, Steve, was the biblical story of the prodigal son. And you'll notice that he was belligerent and disrespectful to his father. He was not a good son. There was a good son, but he wasn't it. And what did the father do? He gave him his share of his inheritance. He didn't tie it to behavior. I'm sure the father had a heavy heart when he did it, but as you read the parable, and I'm sure you know it by heart, the son, with all of his belligerence and all of his stupidity and all of his, you know, all of those things, demands what's his, and the father gave it to him. So I don't know that that is necessarily a paradigm that Jesus is saying that for fathers in your situation that you should do the same thing. But I think at least it should be taken into account that your love for your son or daughter is not conditioned by their behavior. I mean, you can be more or less pleased with their behavior. You can be really sad or even angry at things that your sons and daughters do, but it doesn't change the fact that you love them. I mean, I'm assuming that's true, right? I hope that's true.
Yeah, I guess the order, I mean, I understand that parable, the order in which things are occurring now, you know, it isn't particularly easy for an adult retired person to give up that inheritance now, since the cost of everything is so high. So we never know, you know, coupled with how long are they going to live, all those sorts of things for that to happen. But then the separate part is, does that also encourage perhaps bad behavior? If when you know, the whole paradigm of people waiting for their parents to die and not really, you know, doing much with their own life, because they know that, oh, there's this little nest egg that's coming my way, so I don't have to do much in my own life to even, you know, take care of myself or take care of others. So anyhow, that's
right. Okay. So my question, Steve, and I think I'm tracking with you. So my question is, I'm assuming, because you sound like a younger man, that it's not you and your estate, but rather your parents' estate that would pass down to you and your siblings. Is that right?
Technically both. It's managing another family member's estate where this conversation is going to be hot and heavy. And then it's in my mind, I have three younger children. It's like, is there something I could do that would, you know, on this conversation that would encourage them towards, you know, Catholic lifestyle? If they knew when they were, you know, a certain age, like, well, I'm not going to get any of that because I'm choosing to A, not participate in the faith, or B, you know, whatever it is. I mean, we choose our education. We choose lots of things that we invest in our kids based on moral guidance. Why wouldn't this also be in that same vein?
I'm not saying it couldn't or wouldn't be. I'm just saying I was just trying to get a sense of the parameters involved here. So because obviously if you were among the 10 children, there's a self-interest on your part to get more of the share than less if it were your parents. That's why I asked that question, because sometimes, you know, as you evaluate this, you also have to look at your own motives. What are your motives in this issue? But prescinding from all that, I know a man, I'll share this with you first of all, Steve, I know a man who told all of his 9 children, he said that, and this is not me, by the way, he said that if you want me to pay for your college, I will. I'll pay for your tuition, but you have to go to a Catholic college or university that I pick. So Christendom College, for example, I think that was one of the ones on his list. If you want me to pay for your college, I will, but you have to go to a college that I know is going to inculcate the Catholic faith in you. If you don't want to go there, that's fine, but I'm not going to pay for it. I thought that was wise. And some of his children took him up on it, and some of them didn't, but it was their free choice, and he offered them a really nice gift, but there was a string attached. And I thought that was wise on his part to, you know, like the old saying goes, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. Well, in his case, he put salt in the oats to make the horse thirsty so that he would drink. And that kind of creativity could work in a situation like this. I don't think there's anything wrong in any way for the parents who are going to bequeath this legacy to their children to have certain conditions applied to it. Sometimes it's you have to reach this age before you can get to the money, or you have to finish college before you can get to the money, or it could be tied to anything you want, really. That'd be up to you. But I don't see on the face of it that there would be anything wrong with an outcome-based distribution of funds on the basis of performance or, you know, fulfilling some requirement. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Now, that gets into the question of, well, if you've got 10 children, and what if 3 of the children get 80% of the funds and 7 of the kids get whatever's left? It seems like that is a recipe for disaster in a family, that for that next generation, if they for the rest of their lives are going to be carrying this feeling of resentment that why did I get this little amount and he got so much more? Well, he was the super Catholic. Well, okay, but it's just not fair. I mean, I could easily see lots and lots and lots of problems among the siblings and even their children after them if it's not handled very delicately. So my default, and this is how my will is set up, is that all 11 of my children share equally in whatever's left. Nobody gets any more than any of the other ones. And in the course of their lifetimes, some are going to be more successful or more, you know, more fervently Catholic. Some will be less. Some will be, you know, I don't necessarily agree with all decisions that all of them make, but I'm not going to give one of them more than any of the other ones because I don't want to set them up for squabbling and resentment in the future. So that's just how I've handled it. When I say I mean we, my wife and I have decided on that. But we've divided everything evenly.
Right. Okay. Got it. Now, I guess, and assuming that any one of the children, you know, in their lives now where you have the ability to make a change started to, you know, act and behave ways that just, again, or say were clearly against God, against you, that sounds like that wouldn't change your handling.
I don't think it would. So let's say that I had a son who did what the, you know, the prodigal son did and was belligerent and wanted nothing to do with the family or anything like that. I mean, I've never really thought about that scenario because it's not happening. But in theory, I don't think I would say to him, okay, you're out of the will. Sorry. Goodbye. I don't think I would do that. I think I would say, you know, I love you and I want to be, I want to have a relationship with you, even if you don't want to do that. And in the end, son of mine, I am leaving to you a portion of whatever's left over as a gesture, maybe a final gesture of goodwill and love. And who knows, it could be that something like that is the means by which God can change that person's heart after the fact, you know, where the last thing his dad did wasn't a slap in the face. It was a generous gift. And I could see that maybe softening somebody's heart.
Yeah, valid point. I guess the only other part that when it comes to the investment and taking care of the care and welfare of the parents, you know, oh, I guess you already answered this. I guess it would be, it might be prudent to give a slight increase for those who are willing to sacrifice and do the daily work that, you know, mm-hmm. and when it comes to taking care of the elderly, I think that
seems
a managerial decision.
Yeah, and one way to handle that, you probably have already thought of this, Steve, is you could say, you could stipulate in the will that, so here's the pot of money or whatever is left over. And the first thing is those who have done these things, who have, you know, helped to fund mom and dad's, you know, things that they had to pay for, they'll be reimbursed because it's only fair that they put out the money. And so those, whatever those expenses may be, those will be reimbursed first. And then after those are reimbursed, everybody shares equally. Because then somebody who didn't do anything financial to help mom and dad don't really have a leg to stand on to say, well, how come I get less? Well, we all get less. All of us do. And those who got reimbursed, the only reason they got reimbursed is because they spent money out of their own pocket to help mom and dad. You didn't do that. Therefore, there's nothing to reimburse you for. But if you had done it, you would have been reimbursed too. So after expenses, everybody shares equally. That's another way you might try it.
Yeah. Okay. Good stuff.
Let me recommend a book. Yeah. Oh, you're welcome, Steve. Here's a book you might find interesting. It's called Finish Faithful: How to Create a Lasting Christian Legacy for Your Family. And it's by Mark Henry. He's a financial planner and kind of a big guy in that world. And that book, I think, is very helpful in at least framing your own thoughts as you approach this topic. Finish Faithful is the name of the book.
Finish Faithful. Got it.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. God bless, Patrick. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate that. And if there is any room left in that estate, please remember Relevant Radio. And I mean, I'm serious. We do from time to time greatly benefit from people who remember Relevant Radio in their wills. So as you're planning your will, not just you, Steve, but just in general, anyone listening, as you're planning your will, and you feel moved to share something with Relevant Radio for what you've received, please remember Relevant Radio. 888-914-9149. Now we'll go to Kate in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. Hi, Kate.
Good morning.
Hi.
I was calling because I just had a question. We have two churches that are within about 3 miles of each other.
Okay.
We go to both, depending on our schedule. One has... they're both taken care of by the same priest. He does the masses, both churches, and the liturgies, or the, you know, everything's the same. And then we're not sure if we belong to both by way of belonging to one, because they're sort of like sister churches. Like the one church will have a bulletin from the other church in the lobby.
Okay.
And such. I didn't know how that worked. Do you happen to know?
Well, this sounds like it might fall into the church's canon law area, where, as I understand it, the law says that you, as a Catholic, you belong to the parish within whose territorial boundaries you reside. Now, canon law used to stipulate that you had to go to that parish, and the law was revised so that you are free to go to a different parish if you wish to do so. So I don't know juridically whether or not those two sister parishes are considered one parish that has two locations. That happens sometimes. That may be the case, in which case, if you are a registered member of one, you're a registered member of that parish that has two or more locations. That could be one possibility. The other possibility is if juridically each of these parishes is a freestanding, they would call it a juridical person. In other words, it has a standing, a legal standing unto itself as a unique parish, a distinct parish. Well, then you would choose one or the other. Now, it doesn't mean you couldn't donate to both. If you feel generous and you want to give back and help both, you can do that. But you couldn't, I don't think you could be registered at both. You'd have to be registered at one or the other. And you could give to one or the other, or you could give to both. But you'd have to find out whether or not you're dealing with a single parish that has multiple locations or two distinct parishes.
So if they both have a different name, they could still be two branches of the same church?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So when consolidations take place, and unfortunately they're, you know, happening quite a bit, where some parishes get closed, other parishes get consolidated, but they don't necessarily close the individual churches. What they would do is they would assign, let's say, one priest to St. Miscellaneous Parish, and he's also responsible for, you know, St. Mary Magdalene Parish and St. Teresa of Avila Parish, and those three parishes within X number of miles are merged into a single parish. And everybody can continue going to the different locations if they wish, but they're all registered and under a single parish. It could be something like that. Okay. I just don't know.
Yeah, the confusion comes for us mm-hmm. because we want to volunteer at both for different things. And I'm like, well, maybe we can't officially nothing volunteer if we're not.
No. There's nothing preventing you from doing anything like that. You could volunteer at both. You can donate to both. You can teach CCD at both. You can go to Mass at both. If they're two different parishes, then you'll be registered in one or the other, but you can do all of the above. If they're one parish that has more than one location, then, you know, it becomes simpler that way.
Okay. Great. Yeah, I didn't want to start volunteering for stuff at the wrong one if I wasn't officially a member. And I did leave a message with the staff there, but they didn't get back to me yet, so I figured you might know.
Well,
thank you. That was very enlightening.
I'm glad. Thank you, Kate. I appreciate it. There is a website that I turn to from time to time in my research on canon law issues. It's called canonlawmadeeasy.com, canonlawmadeeasy.com. The canon lawyer who runs that is Kathy Caridi, and so she really is helpful. I've never met her. I'm not even sure where in the country she's located, but this website is very helpful because it makes a lot of the vagaries of canon law accessible in language that non-canon lawyer people like me can understand. So if you had a question, not just you, Kate, but in general, anybody listening, if you had a question that pertains to canon law, I wouldn't be surprised if she has an article on that already. She's run that blog for years. And so all you would do is type into the search bar the keywords that you're looking for, and don't be surprised if she's already got at least one article that would lay it out for you. That's a nice free resource for any lay Catholic who's just interested in knowing what does the church's canon law say about this, that, or the other. CanonLawMadeEasy.com. All right, this is a good time to take a break. I have an email that came in just a moment ago telling me why I just gave bad advice. And this lady's going to correct me, and I will read her email when we come back from this quick timeout, so please stay right there.
Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code PATRICK for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
All right, let's get back to it. The number to dial is 888-914-9149. Now, I mentioned before the break that I had an email that came in from a nice lady named Cheryl listening on the Relevant Radio app. And Cheryl, I'm guessing you're listening right now because it's only been less than an hour, I guess, since you sent me your email. So here's what Cheryl said. Patrick, you gave bad advice for the first time since I've been listening. I love you and your show, but I have to say you gave bad advice to the woman whose assistant RCIA director told her not to teach about mortal sin. Instead of just telling her to find a new parish, I really think the better thing to do is advise her who to report this problem to, and then She can go to a different parish if they don't correct the problem. She would have at least tried to correct the problem and help out her fellow man, even if it's not her responsibility. We all need to do what we can for God's truth and to do nothing, and that's all in caps, without first trying to do something, and that's all in caps, to help others know the truth is, in my mind, a mistake. Fair enough, and I don't disagree with the last part of what you just said, Cheryl, but if you go back and re-listen to the program, you'll hear that I told her you can write a letter and you can and talk, and I didn't use the word complain, but you can indeed write a letter. You can point out that this is a problem. But what I said is I had a feeling deep inside, oh yeah, that a letter is not likely to change that. So I was not telling her not to do something about it. In fact, the way she described it to me gave me the impression that she had a conversation with the assistant RCIA director.
I think you said it's like fighting City Hall.
Yeah, you can't fight City Hall. I think I did say that. I did definitely say you can write a letter, but I followed that with a bit of pessimism by saying I doubt that it's likely to change anything. So my emphasis, Cheryl, was on what I perceive to be the futility of anything ever coming from it, but not that she shouldn't try to do anything. And I've been down this road before, unfortunately, and I know that if you've got not just a rogue assistant RCIA director saying and teaching such things, but as Yoli had said, if the pastor himself is saying the same thing, and it sounds to me like she had a conversation with the pastor and he said, no, this is inappropriate, I think is the word that she used, to be teaching the RCIA people about mortal sin, which is ludicrous. So looking at this as the way she described it, and the presupposition is that she had tried to do something to no avail. And so my mentioning that she could write a letter, but that I doubted that anything would come from it, and therefore it would be easier all the way around for her to go to a different parish. So I do appreciate you writing to me, Cheryl, I really do. But with all due respect to you, I stand by what I told her, and I think it was good advice. And we'll see how it works out, whether she takes it or not, I don't know. But if you went back and re-listened to it, I think you would find there's more there than maybe what you picked up on it first. Thank you. 888-914-9149. That's the number to call. Let's go now to Mark. We were actually going to Mark in Drexel Hill, PA. I thought we were. But anyway, welcome to the program, Mark.
Thank you, Patrick.
Yes, sir.
During is the priest consecrates bread and wine into the body, blood of Jesus Christ. And is it at this point that he offers it up to God the Father in sacrifice, similar to that of when the Hebrews offered an animal in sacrifice to God? Is that what happens at every Mass?
Not exactly. I think I understand the question, Mark, but maybe I could put it in a slightly different way. If you read the Epistle to the Hebrews, read the whole thing, but you might want to zero in on chapters 7 through 10. Where it talks about Christ's high priesthood and how his priesthood supersedes and renders obsolete the Old Testament priesthood, which is what you're referring to, and all the animal sacrifice. And in these three chapters, it talks about how those animal sacrifices were simply symbolic and they couldn't actually do anything. They didn't accomplish anything. They were only symbolic. And those priests, it says in Hebrews, had to go back to the altar day after day after day and sacrifice all these animals, and nothing was really accomplished because it was only ceremonial and it was only symbolic. But that Jesus is the perfect sacrifice and also the perfect high priest who offers himself as a perfect sacrifice for us. So at the Mass, this is not a repetition of that sacrifice because it's once for all, as Hebrews reminds us repeatedly. This is a once for all sacrifice, cannot be repeated. So at Mass, the priest is acting in the person of Christ, and maybe another way to say that is that Christ is acting in and through the ministry of the priest, and it's Christ's power in the sacrament that is confected on the altar that is that once-for-all sacrifice that he gave on the cross, and it's represented to us in time and space. So when you're at Mass, you are in a real sense, but you can't see it with your eyes, you are made present at the Last Supper and at Calvary and in the heavenly sanctuary where Christ, our high priest, is offering this perfect sacrifice eternally to the Father. You participate in that once-for-all sacrifice. So it's not in any way the same thing as those animal sacrifices. It has nothing to do with them directly. Other than that, those animal sacrifices in the Mosaic covenant were symbolic and pointing toward what Jesus would eventually accomplish on the cross. If there's a connection, that's the connection. But there's no other connection between the Mass and those animal sacrifices.
Well, thank you. I guess what I'm trying to pinpoint is that it is that the priest is offering Jesus back to God the Father. Is that correct in the persona of Christ?
Well, it is. I think I understand what you're saying. The priest is not re-offering anything. So this is not a repetition of that once-for-all sacrifice of Christ, but rather through the ministry of the priest, as Jesus imparted this power and authority to the apostles at the Last Supper when he said to them, do this. And what he had just done is he had taken bread and wine, and he had said, this is my body that will be given up for you, and this is the chalice of my wine which will be poured out for you and for many. So when the priest does that, not only is he fulfilling Christ's command, but he is also doing what Jesus did, and that is making this sacrifice present then and there to the people. So he's not re-offering it, if I'm understanding you correctly. He's representing what Jesus himself had done. And yes, it is Christ working in and through the ministry of the priest to make that happen.
Well, that's it. You've answered my question perfect. I didn't mean to compare the Old Testament with the New. Nothing can compare to the offering of Jesus Christ at the altar his presence at the altar to an animal of any kind. So, but I mean, it's congruent, or it's similar in terms of an offering, a sacrifice, if you will, not to be compared, an animal to a human being, or to, in this case, the Lord Jesus Christ. So thank you very much, Patrick. And, you're a great listener, which is, it's almost a, I don't know, it's something to be admired. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Kind of you. Appreciate that, Mark. Yeah, there's a lot to be said in the direction of the question that Mark was asking. And, you know, one who has done a great deal of work in this area is Scott Hahn, Dr. Scott Hahn. And among his many books that elucidates these issues, one that any of you who find this question of interest, you know, what is the Mass? What is happening in the Mass? Why do these things happen in the Mass? Why do we do the things in the Mass? What do they mean? Where did they come from? Well, he has a book called The Lamb's Supper. The Lamb's Supper. And it is a biblical elucidation of what you see at the Mass. You know, it's always puzzled me over the years, and I'm a cradle Catholic, so let me put my cards on the table. I'm not a convert. A lot of people over the years have thought I was a convert just because, I guess, in the world of apologetics, many of the people who are like big name people are converts. Marcus Grodi, Scott Hahn, Tim Staples, for example. But I'm one of the token few, at least in the beginning days, 35 plus years ago when I was first starting out, I was one of the token few cradle Catholics. In fact, we weren't even token because we were doing this, we like Carl Keating, and when he invited me to join him at Catholic Answers, so this is like early 88, January, I think, there were no converts to speak of anyway. Many of these people had not yet converted. Scott Hahn had barely just converted a couple of years earlier, although he had not become a national phenomenon. And many of the other household names that you know and have heard about who are converts to the faith, they were still doing what they were doing before they converted to the Catholic Church. So at first, it was really sort of just Catholic folk like us who were reviving the remains, the leftovers, the vestiges of a previously very robust apologetics outreach in the Catholic Church in the United States that went moribund, it went dormant during the time of Vatican II, because wrongly people were being told that apologetics was pre-Vatican II and anti-ecumenical and other such nonsense. And that sort of spread, and a lot of people thought, well, there's really no place for defending the faith. That's retrograde, which is not true. But when we began to revive this, it wasn't like we were suddenly now inventing all of these new things. They were already there. They had just been left lying on the floor. And a generation or two had passed, and nobody bothered with these things. So what did we do? We just picked them up and started using them again and dusted off the old responses to the standard arguments. And, you know, maybe some new insights were gained along the way, that's for sure. But it really is true in the world of apologetics that we sit on the shoulders of giants. And those giants ultimately are the ones who came long before the present era, back to the early centuries of the church. St. Justin Martyr, for example, and his apologetics response to the emperor, telling the emperor why he was wrong for not believing in the one true God and why he shouldn't persecute Christians, etc. So apologetics as such goes back to the time of the apostles. And there was that little dip, that weird, curious lacuna in church history in the United States where apologetics sort of became eclipsed and nobody bothered with it. But in any case, my point is simply this, that as a cradle Catholic, I've always never really understood, not at an emotional level anyway, I think I can understand intellectually, what some of these hang-ups are that non-Catholics have about the Mass, but maybe more specifically, what it is that's going through the mind of a Catholic who says, well, I'm just not being fed at the Catholic Church, therefore I'm going to depart and look for greener pastures. That happens all the time. It's probably happened in your own family, sorry to say. It's a very common thing for Catholics to say, well, I wasn't being fed at the Catholic Church. The Mass is boring. I don't understand it. It's dead here. And then they get invited to go to a megachurch, and there's a seven-piece rock band doing music, and there are Jumbotron screens, and there's a Starbucks in the lobby, and everybody's, you know, hip and young and well-dressed, and they're like, hey, I want to be here. I want to go here. They know my name. I can get involved. There's stuff to do with the family and the kids, and my peers are here, and I feel excited when I go to one of these services, and all of the above. Those, of course, are not reasons to decide to leave the Catholic Church, but I could understand the pull if all you have is this sense that, oh, I'm going to Mass because that's all I've ever done. I'm going to Mass because that's all I know. That's what my parents told me to do. And they did it because that's what their parents told them to do. So I don't really get it. Therefore, I'm going to go where I feel energized and the sermons are exciting and the music is thrilling and I get something out of it because I'm not being fed in the Catholic Church. That's a very common tale. But I can't really understand that emotionally as a cradle Catholic because I've never gone through that. Rather, for me, it's like, when you understand what the Mass is and who you're receiving in Holy Communion, you're receiving Jesus Christ himself, body, blood, soul, and divinity, glorified, resurrected, sitting at the right hand of the Father, and he deigns to come to you and to me in the form of this little wafer, just like he came to us in the form of a little bitty baby in the manger on that cold night in Bethlehem when he was born. And the only people who came to worship him were the scraggly old shepherds, the humble bottom rung of the social ladder shepherds. They are the ones who came in their humility, and they worshiped the God made man in the humility of baby Jesus. So if God can humble himself to become a little baby in a manger in an out of the way place, he can certainly come to you in the form of a host, in the form of a piece of bread, or what looks like bread at this point now. So my thought is simply this, although I've never even in the slightest have been tempted to think like, well, I'm not being fed here. Yeah, maybe the sermon is boring, or maybe it's just not very alive in this parish. I've been to parishes like that. They exist. But when you realize what you have there, this is the Mass. This is the once and for all sacrifice of Christ on the cross that is represented to you. Even though you can't see the angels and you can't see the saints and our Blessed Mother, and you don't see the splendor and the majesty of what's taking place on the altar during Mass, it's all there. And when you realize that, and you realize that, you know, unlike so many other groups out there who preach about Jesus and they sing hymns about Jesus and they talk about Jesus and they read Bible verses about Jesus, that's all great and you should do all that anyway. But unlike those places, you actually get to receive Jesus into your body. Think about that. You know, people say, well, I have a personal relationship with Jesus. That's awesome. I'm happy for you. But I have an even more personal relationship with Jesus as a Catholic than you do. And I'm not saying that to be condescending. Well, what do you mean by that? Well, what I mean by that is I do all the same things you do. I read about Jesus in the Bible. I praise him in my prayers. I thank him for his mercy. I hear sermons about Jesus. I sing hymns about Jesus. I do all the same things you do, but I have one thing that you don't have. What's that? I get to receive Jesus in Holy Communion. There is no more personal relationship this side of eternity than that. And that's a fact. And you as a Catholic should know that. And you as a Catholic should teach your children that. I mean, if you really know what's going on at Mass and you really realize, regardless of how boring the sermon might be, and some sermons are fantastic, don't get me wrong, but some are boring. It doesn't matter all those external things. It doesn't matter. If you are there at Mass and you realize everything that's going on and the majesty and the importance of worshiping God in spirit and in truth, and you are participating in that once-for-all sacrifice of Jesus, our high priest, there's nothing better than that. There's nothing higher than that. And a seven-piece rock band at a megachurch cannot compete with that, obviously. That's why you go to Mass, because you have everything given to you at Mass in the Holy Eucharist, and everything else that takes place at Mass, the liturgy of the word, etc. So never let the words cross your lips that you're not being fed in the Catholic Church. You're being fed with the bread of life. You're being fed with Jesus Christ himself. And those Catholics who know that, doesn't matter what the surroundings are like, they're there for Jesus. And I'll leave it at that. So important. I can't underestimate or underemphasize, rather, just how important this realization is. And when you get it, you'll get it. And when you get it, you got it. And then give it. I'll be right back. This hour is sponsored by Solidarity HealthShare, the first to offer comprehensive sharing for prescription medications. Check now to see how much you can save. Go to CatholicHealthShare.com.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back. I have a note here that came in from a lady who told me her name, but she asked me to keep her anonymous. And I think she's listening. Actually, she didn't tell me where she's listening from. So here goes. She says, I went to Walmart yesterday and was taken aback when I spotted in a prominent location in a main aisle a bright, inviting display for a morning after pill called Julie. I did some research online and learned the mission of the developer of this contraceptive and of Walmart. I buy many of my needs at Walmart because they offer overall the greatest variety and the cheapest cost. I'm on a fixed income, but I do have room to make cuts. Should I move on to a new grocer or just ignore the display and continue to shop at Walmart? Thank you. I have never heard of this, but in the time that I had during the break, I looked it up too. And indeed, this is a product that is available at Walmart. So it's called Julie Levonorgestrel. It's a tablet that is being advertised as an emergency contraceptive. Now, I'll read to you the product details, and maybe you've already read it, but for those who are listening. Julie is a morning after emergency contraception that helps prevent pregnancy before it starts when taken within 72 hours after you know what. The sooner it's taken, the better it works, It works by temporarily delaying ovulation or the release of an egg from the ovary. No egg, no fertilization, no pregnancy. Julie will not work if you are already pregnant, and it won't impact an existing pregnancy, and it doesn't affect your ability to get pregnant in the future. And then it gives some bullet points below that, so that if you're interested in, you know, more specifics, it gives you that detail. But the reason I'm reading this to you is because at least it's not as bad as it could be, first of all, and that is, at least it's not an abortifacient pill. This will not abort an already conceived unborn child. This will not cause an abortion, in other words. And that, although it's still something that would be morally wrong for a Catholic to use, it's less bad than it would be if it were something that actually would take the life of the unborn child. So I wanted to make that point clear, not because I'm saying, you know, hey, this is great. It's just that it's less bad than it could have been. So that being the case, what do you do? Where do you shop? Well, think about this for a second. If you were to shift your purchasing habits, and maybe you have to go to, I don't know, let's say Rite Aid or Walgreens or one of the other chain pharmacies, you'll find contraceptives there as well. If you go to Kroger or Save-On, or probably not Save-On, Vons, Albertsons, many of the other big box chain grocery stores around the country, most of which by now are probably already owned by Kroger, you'll find contraceptives there as well. So if you wanted to take a stand and say, I'm not going to purchase at Walmart anymore because they have this kiosk for the Julie morning after pill, I would certainly applaud you for your heroic dedication to trying to avoid giving money to a company that in some way is doing things that are wrong. I don't think anything less than heroic is going on there, especially for you if you live on a tight income. And for you, it might indeed impact how much money you have at the end of the month, because you may have to spend more on products that might be at a higher cost elsewhere. So if that's the decision that you decided to make, I would applaud you for it. But the church would not require you to do that. The church would not say that because of this, you now are committing a sin or you're doing anything immoral if you were to shop at Walmart or whatever the store might be, any of those other, what's the word I'm looking for, the pharmacy chains, etc., or Kroger for that matter, or any of the other big stores like that. Because one of the problems of our generation is that these things have become so commonplace and so ubiquitous that it's really difficult to try to do business with companies that don't in some way have a connection with it. That's not condoning it by any means. It's just looking at things the way they really are. I've talked about this before, the batteries you buy, the airline tickets you buy, the insurance you have on your car, the computer you have in your office, the food products you have in your kitchen, the clothing that you wear, all of these things that touch your daily life in so many ways, the merchants and the companies who manufacture these things, so many of them now are in some way or another tied into things like this. So it makes it, in some cases, almost impossible for people to sidestep and figure out, well, how can I shop in a way that won't involve me in some way in one of these companies? It's just become increasingly more difficult, is what I'm trying to say. So I can't tell you what you should do, but if you're asking for my advice would be maybe write a letter to the Walmart corporate offices and object to this. If you wanted to tell the manager, I don't believe that this is moral, and I wish you didn't have this in the store. In other words, you can voice your displeasure. You can register your complaint. And obviously, you know, like we talked about with another scenario earlier in the show today, the likelihood of your complaint actually amounting to them changing is, I think, virtually nil. But it doesn't mean you couldn't do it. And then you also would have had the opportunity to voice your complaint about it. But nonetheless, coming back to your question, if you continue to get those things you need to get, your medications or whatever other things you need to get at Walmart, you, in my view at least, and I think I can speak for the church on this one, you would not be committing a sin. You would not be doing, you would not be compromising yourself in any moral way. I hope that's helpful to you. And I almost said her name. So I hope that's helpful to you. And thanks for writing to me. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Tripp in San Antonio. Hi, Tripp.
Hey, how are you doing?
Doing well, thank you. Not too bad for a sinner.
I know, me too. I called you back in April and was asking you about the Catholic Church, and you explained that how the outside was and then inside. So I've been going every Sunday, got into RCIA. There's about 40 of us in there. And the church, it's wonderful. There's crying babies everywhere, families with 8, 10, 12. And then whenever they go up for communion, because I can't go, and I get out of the pew and let them go up there, they smile. They don't look at me like they judge me or anything, but it is a lot better than that mega church and all of what you're talking about. It's not, I feel God now in the Holy Spirit.
That's good. I'm happy. And I'm glad that you decided to make the journey. Do you know yet when you will come into the Catholic Church? Will it be next Easter or Vigil?
It's supposed to be, we're going to get out of RCIA on December the 11th, and my spiritual director told me by January.
That's wonderful. I'm so happy for you, Tripp.
And it's funny because I'm craving to go up there to have that Holy Communion. And I'm looking forward to it so much. But even though I haven't taken it, I'm in the right place.
Oh, you are indeed. You are indeed. And as I often say, Tripp, come on in. The water's terrible. Just be aware. You're coming into the Catholic Church, ever ancient, ever new, the church established by Jesus Christ nearly 2,000 years ago. And it's filled with saints and sinners and everyone in between. And you're coming into the Catholic Church at a time of turmoil and all kinds of things that always seem to always be going on in the Catholic Church for the last 2,000 years. It always seems to be that way. And I guess that's the way Christ planned it. But don't fear those things. In a way, it's like getting on the Ark of Noah when the flood is about to break loose. And those people, eight in all, who got on the ark, they were saved in the flood. But try to imagine, Tripp, what that ark must have been like for 40 days and 40 nights. Can you imagine what it smelled like in the ark?
It must have smelly and dirty.
To high heaven. Yeah, imagine all those. I mean, just the elephants alone, not to mention all those other critters in there. It must have stunk to high heaven. And talk about an unpleasant ride. If you have seasickness, uh-oh. Because those huge waves, and we're talking about a very primitive structure, I mean, without any hydraulics or anything to make you have a more comfortable ride. It must have been miserable for 40 days and 40 nights on the Ark of Noah. But guess what? That's where I would want to be, knowing what was going to happen. And everybody who didn't get on the Ark, they didn't make it. So I say that not to in any way discourage you or in any way make you feel less in your love for the Catholic Church, but just to kind of be a bit of a realist here, the Catholic Church is a messy place, and you've got a lot of messy, sometimes angry people. Thankfully, most Catholics are not like that, but there are some. And so just be aware that you're not stepping into this institution where everybody is perfect and always smiling and will always treat you nicely, but that's okay because you're not there for them anyway, that you're there for Jesus. So welcome aboard. I'll give you a little anticipatory welcome.
The other thing is it is the true church. It is the one that Jesus established. I know that for sure.
Mm-hmm. I believe that. I really do. Well, Tripp, thank you. Thanks for giving me an update on how things are going. And maybe once you've come into the church and you you feel like giving a call back, I'd love to talk to you then as well. And in the meantime, I'll pray for you, Tripp. So happy you're on the journey. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Kate in Salmon, Ohio. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning, Patrick. I have a future daughter-in-law that has been raised some Baptists, some Calvary. She went to Mass with my son and just doesn't get it. And he's fairly well catechized, but anyway, I just wondered if you have a resource you could recommend, like your top pick, because I know there are so many out there, A Minute with the Church and all the, or with the Mass. What would you recommend for somebody who isn't necessarily like a big, doesn't want to be intellectual about it and would, you know, short snippets or something sort of light that might draw her, or if in their marriage preparation, if that just might be the way to kind of dip her toe in things. You know, I don't want to be now, overbearing at all.
Now, did you say that she's going to Calvary Chapel? Did I hear that right?
She has in the past. Her family is kind of Baptist, you know, kind of moves around a little bit.
Yeah. I would recommend a book that I happen to edit, but that's not the reason why I'm recommending it. It's called Surprised by Truth. Have you heard about that one?
Okay. Yeah, I've actually read that.
Ah, okay. So you know the 11 stories of the men and women who became Catholic. Now, there are four books in the series. For her, I would recommend the first one. It's got a red cover. It was published originally in 1994. It has 11 stories. That collection of stories has just an unbelievable track record of helping people in her situation see really clearly. And just some of the miracle stories that I've heard from people directly, them telling me what reading that book, the effect it had on them. So the one that I know for sure tends to work more often than not would be that book. Now, there are other books by other authors, too. I recommend Dr. Scott Hahn a lot, and he's got a number of books. If you just look up his name online, you'll find them.
So it's something that specifically would maybe help her with the Mass, or is that maybe not the best place to start? I guess it's maybe what you're saying is the surprise truth might just be better.
No, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that if the Mass is the thing she really wants to focus on, then yes, surprise by truth will help her, because in and around those stories, as you know, they do talk about that as Protestants looking at the Mass. But in the case of Dr. Scott Hahn's book, the one I mentioned earlier would probably be even better. It's called The Lamb's Supper. And that's a book just on the Mass, for not just for Protestants, for everybody, but I think it'll speak to her. Hey, Kate, thank you. I appreciate your call very much. And I'll be right back. Hour 3 is about to begin, so don't go anywhere, because I'll be right back.